Do you eat breakfast? A new survey from Dalhousie University says the majority of Canadians still eat breakfast every day, but some of the generational and regional differences are really surprising. We had a terrific conversation with the author of a book called World's Fastest Man, Asterisk, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. For our small town salute, we spoke with an organization called Sea Paws, who has a goal to protect 30% of Manitoba nature by 2030. And inspired by the man who has lived in Stanley Park in Vancouver for 34 years, if you could live anywhere you wanted, anywhere, where would it be? I'm Brett McGarry. Alongside Greg Mackling, we are Mackling and McGarry. And this is the Thursday, April 18th podcast for The Start. It is Mackling and McGarry. Should also add that today is going to be breezy as well. That wind is going to pick up through the morning, northwest 40 to 60 kilometers an hour.
Yay.
Yeah. It's just weird, man. It's just weird. Thought we were out of the woods.
We should have known
final,
better, right?
One final gut punch.
Yeah. Things look good starting on Saturday. Back into the double digits, some sunshine. And things should be hopping, and the weather should be perfectly acceptable when we finally get the schedule for the first round of the playoffs. They released, the National Hockey League did last night, the schedule for all the Eastern playoff series.
Okay.
We're waiting with bated breath to find out when the Winnipeg Jets and Colorado Avalanche will play their minimum four games in their Central Division semifinal series. So we might not hear anything until the Jets Canucks winds up tonight, probably around 9:30, 9:45 tonight. It may even be later than that because there are a couple of games that will decide seeding. In fact, with regard to the Pacific Division, the Vegas Golden Knights and LA Kings both play tonight. And the outcome of the Golden Knights game in particular, if the Golden Knights beat Anaheim tonight, they're playing Edmonton in the first round.
Okay.
Good luck with that, Edmonton. Here they've had this great big comeback season, and it looks like they're going to end up having to play Vegas in the first round. If that happens, if Vegas wins, LA will play Dallas, Vegas will play Edmonton. It was already decided last night, Vancouver will play Nashville.
Okay.
Yeah. So a couple of things left to be decided, and I must have had five text messages from people yesterday. Have you got any inside information on when the Jets are starting? No, I don't. I have nothing. I have no idea. Only what you've heard out and about in various circles, various speculation, but nothing in concrete yet.
We do have whiteout party tickets to give away.
Hold on. How did you get those now, McGarry? First, we're giving away tickets to this sold out show for the WSO.
Yeah.
And I think the whiteout tickets were available as of yesterday morning.
Yep.
Both parties, games one. Good luck. You can't. There's not.
Are they all gone already?
They're all gone in minutes, apparently.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I tried to get some this morning. I was late to the party, apparently.
Really?
Yeah.
All right. Well, then this is a hot ticket because we've got a four-pack of tickets for the whiteout party. We've got tickets on the start. Hal Anderson is going to have a four-pack to give away on Connecting Winnipeg, Jim Toth Show, and the news with Rich and Julie today and tomorrow. So we've got whiteout party tickets to give away, and we will do that at 9:15, but we'll give you the choice because the Star Wars A New Hope in Concert is also a hot ticket. So at 9:15, our contest winner will choose. We've also got tickets to give away for the Burt Block Party. We'll do that just after 7:50. Greg's already cooked up a trivia question for you. And later this hour, we'll do our first giveaway. We've got tickets for AEW All Elite Wrestling, May 1st,
Canada
Life Center.
We had that terrific visit with Julian Pelicano yesterday.
Yeah,
I meant to ask Julian if he's ever seen WSO tickets on StubHub.
Are they?
I don't know. Right? These show the show, right? The Star Wars show on May 3rd, May 4th, sold out. So are there actually ticket resellers out there that are making money on these symphony shows? reselling their tickets for more than face value?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question, because these things did sell out pretty quick for these Star Wars shows. I don't think it was instantaneous, but I remember looking a couple of weeks after they went on sale, thinking, I should buy these tickets, and they were almost gone already. I'm pretty sure at that point, the Saturday, May the 4th, which is Star Wars Day, May the 4th be with you, that would sold out almost instantaneously, I believe.
That's fabulous.
Yeah, so good for the WSO. So we got lots of stuff to give away this morning. And a bit later on, GMAC, at 9:35, we are going to move from the ice to the track.
We are going to move from the ice to the track. Let's see here. I was pulling some audio to set this up. Here, this is who we're going to have here.
This is Ben Johnson, 88 games, 100 meter gold medalist.
Okay, we're not going to have Ben Johnson, but we are going to have author Mary Ornsby, who was in Seoul, who followed the story, the saga in 1988 of Ben Johnson. That's audio from a 2017 Australian commercial for legalized gambling. We'll play a bigger chunk for you later in the morning. It's absolutely hilarious. Lots of people didn't like it because it poked fun at Ben Johnson and his performance-enhancing drugs, and some other athletes make, you know, actor portrayals of other athletes in this commercial. But we'll talk about Ben Johnson, the legacy, not only in Canada, but in track and field and sport, maybe all together. Ben Johnson, to my memory, you know, between he and, I would say, Lance Armstrong, probably the two shining examples of those, have been absolutely persecuted with regard to their drug use, their performance-enhancing drug use, greater than any other athletes. There are more, of course, but those are the two most glaring examples. And they've paid a price, even though their sports were absolutely rife with people using performance-enhancing drugs. They just weren't the champions that these two were, and they just didn't get caught. And if they got caught, people covered it up for them. It's a fascinating story.
Cool. Yeah, and hearing a piece of that audio reminds me of, I guess this was almost 20 years ago now, where, do you remember Ben Johnson? He endorsed a product, I believe it was an Australian energy drink called Cheetah Power Surge. And he would say, "I cheetah all the time." So he kind of leaned into it himself.
Got to do what you got to do, right? You got to pay the bills.
Even if you have never been to Vancouver, like me, you have likely heard of Stanley Park, which I have. But if you haven't, imagine Assiniboine Park where the Forks is. That will give you some idea of the type of environment we are talking about, and substitute the red and Assiniboine rivers for the ocean.
Yeah, here is the headline. Meet the man who's lived in Stanley Park for 30 years. It is the top story at globalnews.ca this morning. And Alyssa Thibault of Global News BC takes us inside the life of a man who's lived in the heart of one of Vancouver's most famous and most cherished places.
There had been stories about someone living for decades in Stanley Park, so we just started asking some questions. We were introduced to Chris, and after a number of meetings, we started talking about him sharing his story. Now, this is not about the housing crisis or the cost of living. This is a man who made a conscious decision to live relatively off-grid, making art in the middle of a city.
Good morning.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Good. Meet Stanley Park's longest resident.
Hi, my name is Christensen Bailey. Chris is good. I've been living here for 34 years now.
Since 1990, Chris Bailey has lived in the forest in the middle of Vancouver.
When I first went in there, I was bagging geese and cooking them. The first 17 years in here were candlelight.
But at age 74, and with trees around his campsite being cut down, leaving him exposed, Chris's time in the park is coming to an end.
Do you think you have achieved what you came here to do?
Oh, beyond what I ever expected.
This is his story.
It's 2 degrees right now.
How much?
It's 2 degrees right now.
2 degrees. No problem. These are a good jacket.
Everything about Chris's campsite is simple but functional.
The rain factor that comes down just like water off a duck's back.
Accounting for the rain and the cold.
Right, you got a blanket, one sleeping bag, two, three, and a fourth. So that's good for like 20 below.
The roof is made of clear tarpaulin and old fishing nets, so natural light beams through. Flowers add colour, and one side of the tent is always open, so birds can fly in.
The chickadees are a godsend, really. It's a whole relationship that, say, over 7 or 8 years has kind of been really total support.
Chris visited Vancouver in 1981 on a hitchhiking trip from Toronto. That was his first experience camping in Stanley Park. The combination of the forest and the ocean in the middle of a city drew him back less than a decade later when Chris turned 40, and he never left.
So the story, of course, is fascinating, and there's so much you will learn about this man. Once again, the headline, Meet the Man Who's Lived 30 Years in Stanley Park, globalnews.ca for the entire fascinating story.
Now, Brett, I can already hear people asking, if not yelling at the radio, wait a minute, why would they just let him stay there?
Despite his camp being fairly hidden, Chris's presence wasn't a secret.
Because if he didn't come by, we would go out and check on him.
Now retired Vancouver Police Constable Mike Keller first met Chris Bailey in 2003.
He seemed to be very, very well equipped for himself, like he was very self-sufficient.
Keller spent 20 years with the VPD's mounted unit in Stanley Park. It's their job to know who's in the forest.
We were really focused on the people that were drug addicted, alcohol addicted, involved in crime, maybe using the park as a place to hide or even do crime. Chris was not one of those people.
There have been a lot of people living in the park, and I think a lot of people will be surprised by that.
Sergeant Susan Sharp has known Chris since 2010. She says during her time with the VPD, there have been around 10 long-term residents in Stanley Park, all men over 50. Chris's stay is the longest.
So more, once again, globalnews.ca for this fascinating story, Brett.
So a little earlier this morning, we took you to Stanley Park. Greg, where's Stanley Park?
Stanley Park is in the heart of Vancouver, right in downtown. It's one of the most beautiful places. Like Central Park in New York is beautiful. It's lush. It's got all sorts of stuff. But the most beautiful urban park in North America, and for my money, is Stanley Park. It's spectacular. If you've ever seen the Lionsgate Bridge, it starts in Stanley Park and goes across the Georgia Strait to North Vancouver, to West Vancouver, British properties, you know, that illustrious piece of Vancouver. Anyway, yeah, we introduced you to a gentleman who's been living in the forest in Stanley Park for 34 years.
Okay, and you can read more about that at globalnews.ca or cjob.com. And you're right, I don't think I've ever actually seen a picture of Stanley Park, and I'm looking at it now, and as Liz Lemon used to say, I want to go there. So 204-780-6868, we have a question for you this morning. Actually, before that, Jeff Forte, I have a question for you. Who won the tickets for AEW?
Ron Matichuk.
Ron Matichuk, have some fun in the squared circle on May 1st at Canada Life Center. But we want to know, if you could live anywhere you wanted, carte blanche, where would it be? 204-780-6868. Cameron Poitras, start with you.
Can I be the really lame person and say that Winnipeg? I would actually love to live here. And I want to continue to live here for the rest of my life. And I actually would rather live here than anywhere else. However, I want to get my entire life goal is to get the living heck out of here in the wintertime. I absolutely hate the winter. I can't stand it. So Florida, particularly Orlando, would be a perfect.
You're going to steal mine.
I wouldn't. Are you going to say you'd live at Disney World?
It's Cinderella's castle. They got a beautiful room in there, man.
It is a very nice room, but I would not want to live at Magic Kingdom because of the horrendous crowds and stuff like that. And I wouldn't want to be there every day. So I just like a little condo that my wife and I rent. We'll just chill out, relax, do whatever we want. But be able to stay there for three and a half months of the year. That to me is absolutely perfect.
There's a nice room in Cinderella's castle?
Yeah.
Yes, you have to be invited into it. You can't book it. You can't get in there.
How can both of you know about it?
Oh, what? Is this the royal table? Oh my gosh. Is this the royal table you're talking about?
Well, it's upstairs on the royal table inside the castle, and you have to be invited, and sometimes they'll just pick somebody.
You've been invited?
No, of course not. No, I'm not fancy enough. You have to be like a dignitary or something. Or you can just be a random person. Sometimes they'll just like, they'll be hanging out outside the castle taking pictures, and somebody will come up to you and say, hey, you want to spend the night in there? That's how it works. It would be a once in a lifetime opportunity for sure.
It would be so much fun. Think about it. Shower? Who needs a shower? Just hit up Splash Mountain. I know it's closed down right now, but.
Yes, it's getting a renovation. Yeah.
Okay. So Cam wants to live in Winnipeg, but get out of Winnipeg during the winter. Fortier wants to go to Disney World. Cinderella's Castle. Did you have a plan B, or is that it?
That was mine. I was going to go to Disney World. Like, just think about it. You have all the junk food you could want. It's delicious.
Yeah.
Like I said, you can shower at Splash Mountain. You can go on different rides and have the time of your life. It's a dream. It's a dream.
Mackling, what about you?
The Center Ice luxury box at Canada Life Center.
just live there.
Yeah, the rink would be my very large living room or front yard.
Mm-hmm.
The Winnipeg's second largest television at my disposal when there's nobody around. Right, just use the scoreboard as your big screen TV. I've thought about this way too much. It's totally practical, except for the fact that you're living amongst 15,000 people. You know, 40, 50 times a year.
Once in a while.
Much privacy. But when nobody was around, it would be fantastic.
Unlimited concerts?
Okay. See? There you go.
Mm.
There you go, Jeff.
Unlimited popcorn, too.
Yep.
Beer?
Well, what if you're trying? Yep. What if you got to go to bed early and there's a concert on?
Yeah, just put in some earplugs. It's no problem.
Yeah? Like, would you be able to soundproof this? This box.
Listen, in this fantasy, anything is possible. So yes, yes. I was going to say the Sky Dome Hotel or whatever, but I don't want to watch the Blue Jays. So,
yeah, why would you? Ross Levitan, what about you?
Just anywhere with a beach. I've always wanted to live, whether it's on the ocean or I'll settle for a lake, but I think the ocean would be nice. So maybe somewhere in Nova Scotia.
You want anywhere with a beach, so you want basically sand to be the bane of your existence for the rest of your life?
Yeah, you know what? If that's my biggest problem, things are going all right.
come down to Florida. Me and Cam will treat you good.
No, I'm not picky on where. I like the Canadian amenities. That's probably why I said Nova Scotia, but you know what? I'll be convinced. We can go with Florida.
That's good. Okay.
What about you, Brett?
You know, I the whole amusement park thing kind of threw me off because now I'm trying to reshift. I like the idea of living in an amusement park, and Disney World would probably be one. If I were to pick an amusement park, I'd go with Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio, just because they have so many roller coasters. Eat all the hot dogs you want. But I don't know. Then the castle thing threw me off, too. I think, oh, of course, you know, how many... Cool. How many castles are there that we need to live in a castle, like at the top of a mountain or something, somewhere in Europe? I think of Switzerland. You know, Loren's taken trips to Switzerland, and some of the pictures she sent us from there are insane. So I think that would be lovely. But I was not as you guys have put way more thought into it than I did, and I feel like I have failed this particular assignment.
Well, I'm really going to hold it against you, Brett.
Yeah,
I really am.
Isn't there a spot on top of the Eiffel Tower? I think there's a room up there as well. I don't know 100%. I'm just going off by.
Then you'd have to live in Paris, though. That's a big drawback.
Bonjour.
That's a great question. I guess there must be because the Eiffel Tower in Las Vegas, which is not nearly as big, but it's still gigantic, has a restaurant.
That's true.
At least halfway up, if not near the... No, I think it's halfway up, and then you can continue to go
further
up
if you want to. I don't think there's any enclosed space on the Eiffel Tower, but I have never been
there. No. Vegas would be an interesting place, too, but
I couldn't get super specific.
Yeah, I think there would be like night, because there, of course, there's really, really nice neighborhoods in Vegas. It's not just the Strip like it used to be. But like, I could not deal with the, I couldn't deal with those summers. I could not deal with it.
The heat?
I couldn't. No, I have to totally avoid anything like that. Like Winnipeg is pretty much perfect. Like I like the heat, but not too much.
In
like,
the 70s, there was a TV show called Vegas. Dan Tana. I can't remember who played Dan Tana. But he could drive his car right into his house. And I thought that was the coolest thing. He basically lived like in a warehouse unit. And that was his apartment place. And he drove his Corvette. I think he had a Corvette that he drove, or a Thunderbird, and he drove it right in.
Robert Urich.
Oh, yeah, Robert Urich. Yeah.
So at 204-780-6868, if you could live anywhere you wanted, where would it be?
The more specific you get, the better chance you have at winning the prize. How's that?
For the chance to win tickets either for Star Wars A New Hope, WSO, that's happening Friday, May 3rd at the Concert Hall. That show is sold out. And the Whiteout parties are sold out too, but we got tickets for them. Not sure which game yet. We're still sorting out some details on that, but we've got a 4-pack of tickets up for grabs. So we're going to pick our winners at 9:15. It is Mackling and McGarry. Going to do things a little bit different this half hour. We're going to bring on somebody in our next segment. Usually if we have a guest, we bring them on here, but they're going to join us at 7:15. The food professor is going to join us to talk about breakfast habits across the country. Some interesting differences depending on where one lives in Canada. And speaking of where one wants to live, we're asking you this morning, if you could live anywhere you wanted, carte blanche, where, just let your mind run wild. Where would it be? And GMAC, we discussed the Eiffel Tower in our last segment.
Yeah, Jeff Forche with this gem.
Isn't there a spot on top of the Eiffel Tower? I think there's a room up there as well. I don't know 100%. I'm just going off by.
Then you'd have to live in Paris, though. That's a big drawback.
Bonjour.
That's a great question. I guess there must be.
And indeed there is. Listener Jason texting us and just looked it up. Apparently there is an apartment at the top of the Eiffel Tower that was created by the designer. Yeah, Gustave Eiffel. He incorporated an apartment for himself at the top of the tower. Now apparently you can go see it. Just wanted to let you know. Thank you, Jason. We appreciate that. And I found a really cool article at Architectural Digest about this. They've actually opened another apartment lower down on the sort of the first level that you can rent, and then you can take tours of this apartment at the very, very top.
Really?
Mannequins of Eiffel and Thomas Edison inside this apartment. So yeah, you can actually take a tour of it at the very very tippy top.
That is so cool. I had no idea that existed. So thank you, Jason, for confirming that, and thanks Forche for putting that on our radar. So continue to weigh in. Where would you want to live? 204-780-6868. Tickets up for grabs for Star Wars A New Hope in concert with the WSO on May 3rd. Or tickets for a 4-pack for one of the Whiteout parties. We'll pick our winners at 9:15. And we've got Burt Block Party tickets to give away later this hour, just after 7:50. I know you like to stop for a steeped tea from time to time. Do you eat breakfast, GMAC?
No.
Forte?
Sorry, I was just showing somebody something.
Okay, yeah. Do you eat breakfast?
You know, I do have some porridge that I gotta make, and I just ate some fruit, but no, I don't really eat breakfast.
Yeah.
Sounds like breakfast to me.
It's,
porridge and fruit, that would qualify.
Well, I eat it when I'm at work. Like, it's not like I sit down for a meal.
Okay, yeah, yeah, not doing that at 3:30.
Yeah, I stopped eating. I used to eat, at the very least, a bowl of cereal.
Before coming to work?
Yeah. Every day, I'd get out of bed and wander into the kitchen and pour myself a bowl of Raisin Bran or whatever, chocolate frosted flakes for a time. I still remember when Munther Zeed from Food Fair dropped some off when I was lamenting.
It's like a case.
Yeah, because I was like, you can't get chocolate frosted flakes in Canada, and I've emailed Kellogg's. And then Munther says, yeah, we've got him. And he dropped him off later. That was years ago when we were still on afternoons, I think. But then I just, in the last, I don't know, 4 years or so, I stopped. And I don't really know why. I think it sort of morphed. It went from eating breakfast to I started doing protein shakes, and then it became just a glass of chocolate milk, and now it's nothing. It's just water.
The evolution of McGarry's breakfast here is fascinating. But, you know, since we were little, the most important meal of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And how many of us have just let that go the wayside? You know, oh, it's just old wives' tale. Is it?
Yeah, I know. And I know one thing that I do notice is that if I do eat breakfast, I find I'm hungrier through the day. And that's probably a good thing. That means my metabolism is actually going to work. Whereas if I don't eat breakfast, then that's bad for the metabolism and I'm not really helping myself. So let's continue the chat about breakfast. Question for you, do you eat breakfast? If you missed it a moment ago, I don't. I know I should, but I don't. I used to. Not sure why I stopped. And while I'm not alone in this, it appears, Greg, I am in the minority, so says a new survey.
Interesting stuff. That survey comes from Dalhousie University in Halifax, which is home to the food professor, our friend Sylvain Charlebois. Sylvain, good morning.
Good morning.
Do you eat breakfast every day? Ah, there it is. The silence tells the tale.
And frankly, every day is different for me. And so today I think I will have time, but it's probably going to be midway through the morning. And so I'm kind of I sort of eat every day, but not every day, I guess.
All right. It's already 9:16 where you are. So I think breakfast is out. Wouldn't count today. How many Canadians eat breakfast every day, Sylvain?
57%. Which is actually the majority, but as you look at younger generations, breakfasts are actually less popular, and that's really the key here. And I think that both millennials and Gen Zs will have a big say in terms of how restaurants serve breakfast, when they serve breakfast, what they serve, and of course, for foods sold at grocery stores, it would also change just because younger generations don't really prioritize breakfast as much as older generations like Gen X's, boomers, and the great generations.
Yeah, huge difference. Gen Z is 48.8%, and the greatest generation is 74.8%. Yep. But I'm also seeing some interesting differences, like from east to west, there's a big gap.
Yeah, I know, exactly. So where I live, it is the kingdom of breakfasts. All four Atlantic regions are our top provinces in terms of the number of people who would eat breakfast every single day. Manitoba is in the middle of the pack there. My theory about this is that we're an hour ahead of New York, Toronto, Montreal. And let's face it, Canada wakes up when Montreal and Toronto wakes up. And so we got an advantage there. And that's probably why more people do eat breakfast. But in Manitoba, I mean, you're an hour behind Toronto and Montreal. So you got to get going. And my guess is that, and I did live in Saskatchewan for a while, and people actually do get up earlier just because a lot of things are happening already. When you wake up in Halifax, it's still pretty boring.
Tourism Halifax, Sylvain Charlebois. How about gender differences before we let you run, Sylvain?
Well, I mean, basically, the one main thing that I thought was interesting is that 6% of people actually will eat breakfast, but their breakfast will be the dinner's leftovers. And the other thing is that younger generations actually don't drink coffee. Only 30% of younger generations actually drink coffee for breakfast. They will drink something else. And that's another interesting fact for coffee chains out there.
And one final thought, Sylvain, in your survey, were you able to learn some of the common reasons that people give for why they skip breakfast?
Lack of time, not hungry. Those are the top two reasons. And more people are fasting. They're just fasting. They want to lose weight. And so when they look at their at the three-meal institution or the three-meal plan, if they want to skip one meal, it's breakfast. So breakfast, basically, for a lot of people, is not the most important meal of the day.
All right. Sylvain Charlebois, thank you so much for the time and bringing this to our attention. We appreciate it, sir.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Sylvain Charlebois is a food professor at Dalhousie University. Yeah, like, I often just don't eat it probably because I'm not hungry. Like, for example, if I have a day off and I meet friends, if I can go to virtual golf, for example, with some buddies, they like to go on Mondays when they can. And I'd met them once on a day off. They went to Johnny's for breakfast before the golf and I didn't eat because I wasn't hungry enough to eat a big,
sure,
you know, bacon and eggs kind of meal. I got to wait like at least a few hours before I can sit down and eat a decent sized meal. So if I have anything in the morning, maybe it would be a banana.
One of our listeners just pointing out, you know, eating, it's sort of counterintuitive. Eating actually gets your metabolism going.
Yeah.
And your body is like starving. It's craving stuff. And guess where it can get nutrition from fat. So it stores fat. Anyway, we know we should be eating breakfast and I guess most of us are, but a great percentage of us are not.
Time for the Small Town Salute. And this week we want to do something a little bit different because we use this segment as our weekly hall pass to exit the perimeter highway to explore a specific part of our province. But this week, how about we explore the entire province? Because we want to tell you about a terrific organization that has an important goal to protect our province, to protect 30% of Manitoba by 2030, to keep our Canadian wilderness wild forever. And the way we landed on this came in an unexpected way. When I was on location on Saturday at Fred Douglas Chateau, mm-hmm. I was accompanied by a member of our street team. It's a branch of our promotions team who help us out on site with social media and stuff. And that street teamer on Saturday was Katie, whom I've worked with many times before, but it's been a while since I've seen her. And she informed me she now has a full-time job at a place called Sea Paws. The name of the organization rung a bell, but I wasn't quite sure. So I asked her about it. She was super passionate about it. So I thought, let's bring them on.
Okay, so let's do that. Mira Oberman is Director of Communications and Public Programs for the Manitoba Chapter of Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, also known as Sea Paws. Brett, you had a chance to speak with Mira yesterday, who says their mission is to protect at least half of Canada's lands and waters for future generations of people and wildlife.
Well, right now, Manitoba protects about 11.1% of our province. And the really great news is that that 30% goal isn't just our goal. It's also the goal of the Manitoba government. So we're very hopeful with this new government and this new commitment to nature that we're going to be able to get to 30% protected by the end of 2030. And we've already had some really incredible progress towards that goal. In January, the Seal River Watershed Alliance of Indigenous Nations in Northern Manitoba reached an agreement that allows for the interim protection of the Seal River Watershed. That is an incredibly beautiful and immense, pristine area of wilderness in Northern Manitoba. Interim protection is there while the governments of Canada, of Manitoba, and of the First Nations work together to determine how best to preserve that area as an Indigenous protected area. And at the end of that process, we're hoping that an area the size of Denmark will end up being protected.
So how do we get there by 2030?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work to get to 30% protection by 2030. Unfortunately, you can't just, you know, draw a circle on a map and say, great, that's protected now. There are some really complicated legal processes involved in establishing a legally protected area. And one of the most important parts is the consultations with the people and the stakeholders who would be affected or impacted by any legal changes in designations. So that's why we've been asking the government to really get to work right away and start the process of working with the existing conservation initiatives in Manitoba and also in helping to identify new areas which could get protected in Manitoba.
And are there other stakeholders you have to or wish to work with? Because, you know, there are other wildlife and nature and wilderness groups who are looking to do similar things to protect our province, right?
Oh, yeah. And it is just wonderful how many different voices for nature we have here in Manitoba. At CPAWS, we love working with other people. We were just, was it last week or the week before, we drove up to Fisher River Cree Nation with the National Audubon Society, bringing them into some work that we've been doing in the Interlake and doing a bird monitoring project. So we've set up these bird recorders and we're going to be listening to the sounds that get recorded at dawn and at dusk to help build the case for conservation in the southeastern Interlake. So there's a lot of organizations in this space. We try as best as we can to work collaboratively together on that. But the most important thing from both the perspective of CPAWS and from the mandate that came down at the province is that we achieve 30% protection by 2030 by working directly with Indigenous communities who have legal rights to be engaged in the process of what happens to their ancestral territory.
Okay, so some people might say, and no, I'm not one of them, but you know, it's better you explain it than I try to explain it. Why do we need to protect this much of Manitoba?
Well, the thing is, we actually need to protect more. Scientists have kind of studied this and told us that if we want to live in a world where we can breathe the air and drink the water, we need to protect about half of our wild spaces so that our ecosystems can continue to function. So the 30% goal is what we hope is a reasonable and an achievable goal that we can reach by 2030. And then when we're done that, we need to keep working because, you know, we live here in Winnipeg. It's easy to not think about where our air comes from, where our water comes from, but we live in a world that is interconnected. And you know, if we don't preserve nature, then there's going to be some very difficult and painful economic consequences and health consequences. You only have to look to last summer with, you know, we had to cancel a paddle night because the smoke from the Northwest Territories had traveled 3,000 kilometers to Winnipeg, and it was still so thick that it was dangerously unsafe to be outside. So we have to protect nature because we have to protect our home. This is where we live.
And really, 50%, like, Manitoba's a big place. I'm guessing that 50% really is not unreasonable given the size of our province.
Yeah, and, you know, that's what we are so incredibly lucky as Canadians and especially as Manitobans that we live in a place where there is still nature to protect. You know, in Europe, they are spending billions of dollars to rewild areas of Europe because they've lost almost all of their original pieces of nature. It's been turned into farms or cities or who knows what. Here in Manitoba, we have original natural areas that have not been altered in any significant way by development. And so we have the privilege of being able to say, okay, what are we going to use for agriculture? What are we going to use for hydro? What are we going to use for mining and logging? Where are we going to develop our urban centers? And we can take that kind of broader approach and find a good balance so we can sustainably develop Manitoba while also retaining key habitats for wildlife, the wetlands that clean the water that we drink, the forests that clean the air that we breathe, and all of these things that make life possible.
So you mentioned the pedal night that was canceled last year. You've got some activities planned for the summer. Do you want to give us a sneak peek?
Oh, absolutely. So in addition to our work on trying to establish large-scale protected areas, CPAWS is also committed to helping people connect to nature. And, you know, we really kind of upped our game on this during the pandemic because I was at home with twin kindergartners and just about losing my mind. And the only way I got through the pandemic was getting my kids out into nature. And I was like, okay, I need to help other people realize how much better your life is when you just get out to the woods for a couple hours and calm yourself down and let your kids learn about gravity by, you know, throwing a stick into the river. So we started the Nature Club in 2021, as soon as people could start gathering again. And since then, we've had, oh God, I think I just looked at it today, almost 20,000 people register for our events in, I guess, the past 4 years. So that's been wonderful. Right now, we are currently offering a monthly group hike at different kind of places within driving, easy driving distance of Winnipeg. In the summertime, we also expand our programming in partnership with the Manitoba Kayak and Canoe Club, and we start and we offer $5 paddle nights to get people out on the river. And we'll also be offering classes in the park. So on an evening in the summer, you can come learn about tree identification or mindfulness or nature discovery backpacks. So anyone who's interested in joining one of our events, they can just simply Google CPAWS Manitoba or try to find our website, cpawsmanitoba.org. We've also got all of our events on Eventbrite in addition to our website, and that's how you can register for them.
Mira Oberman, Director of Communications and Public Programs for the Manitoba Chapter of Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society, a.k.a. CPAWS, joining us for our weekly Small Town Salute. Oh, yeah. Love this song. Small Town Something. So we're asking you this morning, if you could live anywhere you wanted, like anywhere, where would it be? I said maybe like a castle in the mountains of Europe, and listener found one for me. Here's the castle for Brett. It's called Neuschwanstein in southern Germany.
Oh, yeah, that one.
The castle at Disneyland was modeled after it.
So there you go.
And the picture.
Combined that, yours and Fortier's, yeah. And Poitras and...
Yeah, spectacular. But I know why just playing this. Do you see? So one of our runners up here, precursor runners up, kept it right here in Manitoba.
This is where my stepmom grew up.
Yeah.
We want to live in Whitemouth, Manitoba. Totally enchanted by a fantasy where I can live in a small town, small house, small mortgage with a river I can sit by and write and paint and kayak and just exist. Don't need Paris. Just small town, Manitoba.
Love it. Thank you for that. And Henry, another one here, a precursor runner-up before we get to our two winners, our runner-up and our winner, Henry P. And this kind of made us sad for Henry. Henry says, my dream was to live in a log house in Montana. I was almost there a long time ago and always wonder how my life would have turned out if it came to fruition. I had a gorgeous 33-acre plot on the base of a mountain with a creek running through it, cleared a lot and stacked up all the larches to drive for the log house. But I was then kind of forced out of the States due to immigration and business issues. And one day I'd like to go back and see if my house was ever built. And meanwhile, I will just have to watch Yellowstone and pretend to be on that ranch.
Sometimes our dreams are closer to becoming made and coming true than... Sometimes we realize, Henry, that was a tough one to read, my friend.
But you paint a wonderful picture, and I love the diversity, the wild range of responses we're getting this morning. Patricia's our official runner-up. I would love to live in the upcountry area of Maui, says Patricia, with my entire family, and I'd wear a coconut bra and a grass skirt every day. Maui is on the top of my bucket list, and we even named our dog Maui. As a 54-year-old grandma, I would love to learn how to surfboard, and a bonus would be to have Jason Momoa as my friendly neighbor. Jason Momoa.
How friendly, Patricia.
The landscape is stunning, and I could get Lays every day. So there you go. But Greg, our winner is Logan P.
I would live at the woodcutter cabin on Big White Resort. It's a ski in ski out cabin at what I think is the absolute best mountain for snowboarding in the country. In the morning, you wake up, head on the patio, look out at the mountains in the hot tub. Oh, I've seen this cabin. It's spectacular.
You know this cabin?
I looked it up online. Okay. I thought it was another one that I do know. Anyway, after that, strap on your board, head down the hill to the main lift and ride the Ridge Rocket Express. Up the mountain you go, down the bottom, the Black Forest chairlift where they have a sausage and pierogi truck, then head back down the hill right to your front door. Make dinner in your beautiful kitchen, have a shower in the nicest steam shower you've ever been in, pardon me, and Bob's your uncle. With a place like that, you're not inviting your Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob can stay far away. I'll meet you in Kelowna, Uncle Bob.
Well, Logan, congratulations. You get to pick out of the Whiteout Party or Star Wars WSO on May 3rd. Once again, the Whiteout Party is for Game 1, and we have a four-pack on Connecting Winnipeg with Hal Anderson, on the Jim Toth Show, and on the news with Richard and Julie, both today and tomorrow.
So, wow.
Yeah, I don't know how they managed to do that. Didn't you say they were gone?
Sold out minutes yesterday.
Wow, crazy. I want to talk about how it is one of the most memorable moments in Canadian sports history. It became one of the most memorable news stories in Canadian history.
Yeah, we're talking about 1988. Ben Johnson's name became synonymous with both glory and disgrace when he shattered records at the Seoul Olympics, only to be stripped of his gold medal due to a positive drug test. Our next guest is an acclaimed journalist, formerly of the Toronto Star, where she spent 35 years reporting on events like the Olympics. In this book, she unveils a riveting exposé that transcends sports, offering a poignant exploration of fame, ambition, and an enduring quest for redemption, which promises to ignite conversations and challenge perceptions surrounding one of the most controversial figures in sporting history. We say good morning to Mary Ormsby, author, World's Fastest Man. There's an asterisk beside that. The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson. Ah, yes, Mary, the asterisk. How long was Ben Johnson an Olympic champion?
About 3 days.
Yeah, and it was heartbreaking, right? We were, you know, being from Winnipeg, Don Whitman's call of that race is forever legendary and embedded in our memories. And at the time, it was such a source of national pride. But that changed in, as you say, a matter of 72 hours.
It did. It was just Ben Johnson, really, as you've just alluded to, produced the greatest high in Olympic history and the greatest low in Olympic history, not just for Canadians, I think, for around the world. It was enormous news. And after, he really shook up the way we perceived doping in sport and how elite athletes at the very top of their game were able to compete. You know, not everybody was cheating, but in the 80s, it was pretty much the Wild West.
And I think there was a perception up until that point, for the most part, because you'd had the 80 games where America and Canada and the Western countries boycotted, and then the Eastern countries boycotted 84 in Los Angeles. So doping was more, I think, associated with the Eastern Bloc countries at that point in time, if memory serves.
It was. It was very much, you know, the big suspicion was the swimmers, especially the female swimmers out of East Germany, and a lot of the, you know, back then called Soviet athletes at the time. So when someone from North America and the biggest star in the galaxy of sport is caught and disqualified and stripped of his medal and sent home in disgrace, and it seemed like an open and shut case, it was astonishing news. And in some ways, it really did, you know, begin to, you know, educate the public as to this is going on in sport, and what are we going to do about it? But it really did have Canadians on their heels for not just the days after, but for years, quite frankly.
Yeah, I was in grade 4, I think, and or maybe grade 5. But I was a sad kid for quite a few days after that. Things fall apart publicly when the IOC announced Johnson's positive test for performance-enhancing drugs. But the stage for his downfall was set in the years previous. Can you tell us, who is Charlie Francis?
Charlie Francis is someone who is, I think, a little bit misunderstood, but Charlie Francis is a former Canadian Olympian, a 100-meter sprinter. He competed in Munich in 72 and began to get into coaching. So when Ben Johnson, arrived in Canada from Jamaica as a 14-year-old, he met Charlie Francis, and they began training together through the Scarborough Optimist Club at the time. So from his first sort of blush running with track and field, Charlie Francis was his coach, and he was someone who adored his kids, the kids who worked hard, and Ben was one of them. There was Angela Zajenko as well. Some people remember her, wonderful world-class sprinter, and Desi Williams and Mark McCoy and Tony Sharp. But at some point, Charlie was of the mind that, look, we've tried to do it clean, and a lot of your opponents, not all, but a lot of your opponents are using steroids during training to help them through the hard part of the training and the weightlifting and all that in order to get stronger and faster. I think we should do the same thing. He would introduce that to some of his athletes. Some chose to do that, go down that path. And when Ben was 18 years old, Charlie, said to Ben, what do you think? I think this would be good for you. This is the way to become a world beater, because right now you're starting, 3 meters behind these other guys. And Ben would say, I'm in. So Charlie was the pivotal person in that small group of elite sprinters who thought doping was the way to go. We got to keep it secret because it's against the rules. But, in his mind, everybody else was doing it at the highest level. So we've got to play that game too.
All right. So I had some things that I wanted to ask coming into this, but now I just have to ask this question the way you've framed this. Carl Lewis, maybe the only person at that time on the world stage, certainly in America, that was more famous in the world of track and field. For all these years, the allegations, the suspicion, the suggestion is that the American Olympic Committee had covered up positive tests for Carl Lewis ahead of the 1988 Olympics. True or false?
That's a qualified false, because Carl Lewis did test positive for stimulants at the U.S. Olympic trials in the summer, just before the Seoul Olympics. But the U.S. Olympic officials, heard his appeal and decided that it was an inadvertent case of doping.
How public was that, Mary?
That's a great question, because nobody knew about it at the time. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 2003 when a whistleblower released a lot of doping information about athletes, not just Carl Lewis, but Carl Lewis was the one who, grabbed all the headlines, said, yes, indeed, he had failed tests. And at the time, those tests, could have kept him from competing in Seoul. And some Canadians thought they should have, but he was exonerated, and it was all rubber stamped, and he was good to go.
Is it fair to say, though, Mary, that even if Carl Lewis had been kept home from the Olympics, the likely result in the race would have been the same, obviously. We can say obviously or most likely. But also what happened subsequently would most likely have also been true, and that's Ben Johnson would have been caught cheating.
You know what? I don't know the answer to that. That's a great theory. We just don't know. I still don't understand why he had a very high amount of the traces of steroids in his system, the cold metabolites.
We're talking about Ben Johnson.
We're talking about Ben Johnson, yes, right. Of course. And if he had actually, he was a very sophisticated drug user at that point. He would have stopped using the steroids 3 weeks before the Olympics. Had he been caught, there should have been a very small, tiny, wee amount in his urine, but there was a lot. So that's something that I've never been able to solve, and it's always remained quite a mystery to me.
So Ben Johnson was essentially the poster child for the Dubin inquiry. Is it fair that he remains the face of drug use in sports in the eyes of many?
That's a great question, because the IOC did a great job branding him as the greatest, horriblest, most awfulest doping villain ever, and trot him out every time there's an Olympic Games. And it's so unfortunate, because to this day, people are still testing positive for drugs. They're still cheating, and their excuses are still the same. I didn't do it. So in 36 years, what has changed? The answer is, the drug testing methods have gotten far more sophisticated, as have the athletes who have chosen to use performance-enhancing drugs as well, because they're still getting caught.
Mary, there are some that will just say, why do we bother? These athletes, some of them or many of them are going to cheat anyway. Even if they haven't been caught, they're using masking agents or they've figured out the testing process, all sorts of different things that people will say. And so they'll come to the conclusion that we should just stop this, I'll put it in quotation marks, nonsense, and just let athletes, it's their body, let them do what they want.
You know, that argument didn't hold water back maybe in the 1980s, but now you have to actually really wonder, you know, should you just open it up? I personally think that the intention is correct. It's unfortunate people do cheat, but there are a lot of young athletes out there across lots of sports who do not do this. They are clean. They want to do it naturally. So you are trying to protect, if not a fair playing field, then some sort of level playing field where, you know, through this testing here and there, you try to keep things level, try to have as, you know, as fair competition as possible. I still think it's worth it. But you have to wonder, is it just so much effort and wrangling right now? The cost is enormous, but, you know, I still believe it's worth doing, keeping the testing in play.
Mary Ormsby, thank you so much for just we're just scratching the surface here, but yeah, I want to learn so much more about the fascinating life of Ben Johnson, but we got to go, but thank you for joining us. We really appreciate the time.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure. Thank you. Thank you.
Mary Ormsby is the author of World's Fastest Man, asterisk, The Incredible Life of Ben Johnson.